Now seems like it would be a good time to get started. As we're waiting for the last couple people to trickle in, I figured I can give a quick introduction to this panel. And thank you all for being here. We're looking forward to a really exciting conversation, learning from these experts in the field that are really defining the future of cities. So today we're going to be talking about making smart cities smarter. And we have the privilege of having three real experts that are defining what that smarter really means and where we're moving. So I'm really excited to learn from them, and I thought I'd start by just introducing each of them quickly. So Eugenie Teasley is the head of cities at Uber. She's interested in how technology can increase accessibility, affordability, and reliability in travel and mobility in cities. Next, we have Vanessa Lee-Boots, is the founder of District Technologies, a digital layer to the built environment that enables property owners and companies with invaluable data to improve their bottom line and exceed tenant and employee expectations. She's interested in the digitalization of buildings and the public realm, and in the public-private partnerships that will likely need to be forged in order to realize her vision for smart cities. Next, we have Amir Elichai, the founder and CEO of Carbyne, a global leader in public safety technology, enabling real-time emergency communication between citizens and dispatch centers. Carbyne is interested in bringing together a vast range of urban innovations, from security cameras to smart homes and smoke detectors that could work together to enable more efficient and effective emergency response. So we're really excited to have all of you here, and I thought let's just get started. So the first question to kick us off is asking each of you about your definition and vision for the smart cities of the future. So if you had to choose three adjectives to describe your vision of smart cities, what would they be and why? Let's start with Eugenie.
Sure. Good morning, everybody. It's my mic working, first of all. Yes. It's terrifying to be referred to as an expert. If anybody has technical questions, and there are technical people in the room, I may well be having some audience participation in answering some Uber-esque questions later. In terms of three adjectives that I would love to see around smart cities, I think number one would be safe. So how can we make smart cities safer? So I think there are kind of parallels along the panel here. Number two is like cities be fairer and more equitable? At the moment, often the technology is available to those who can afford it and who can access it. So how can we widen that so that it comes across a broader demographic? And the third one is around accessibility. And I mean that both kind of literally and metaphorically and kind of socioeconomically. So how can we help people move reliably from A to B? And how can we do that in a sustainable way? How can we actually help people move from where they are in life to where they want to go next? And make those future options accessible to them too? And how do we do that, again, across a kind of broader demographic reach than currently exists? There are so many cities in the world where there is a kind of ever-widening chasm, even within a city boundary, between those who have and those who don't. And any bridges that we can build between those two, I think, are really, really important.
Vanessa? Great. Hi, everyone. My name is Vanessa. Great to be back in Oxford. I studied here a long time ago.
Not
although
long
I don't
ago
look
me
that old, I guess. True. So it's nice to be back. Three words. I'm sure I answered this email to you, and I definitely don't remember the three words I said a couple weeks ago, so I'm just going to make them up on the fly. For me, so I look at smart cities from a smart building perspective first, because that's what my company does. I used to build co-working spaces like the one we're in right now, so that's how I got into real estate. And I think real estate is one of the most sort of unsexy industries and most undigital, but also has the most opportunity for change. So I actually think it's extremely, personally, I think it's very sexy because we live and work in buildings all day and we forget that, like how important our infrastructure is to our cities and to our day-to-day life. So for me, smart cities would be about connecting back to the user experience, to bringing back the humans, so user-driven. Frictionless, so everything we build and sort of with my company hat perspective on, but it's about having frictionless experiences. It's not about throwing tech into spaces or buildings or cities unless they add value to the user, right? So we've seen a lot of, I used to consult real estate companies who think their buildings are smart just by putting tech into the buildings, and that's not how it works. It's about bringing the feedback loop to the users to have a better experience in their day-to-day, so solving real problems. And lastly, I guess I would follow you, Eugenie, with like equality. I think we have a huge widening socioeconomic equality gap, and with urban population ever increasing, we need to figure out ways of having everyone have better experiences in big cities, because that's ultimately the job, where the jobs are. And I think that's also going to change, but that's a different topic. We can talk about micro clusters and outside of cities later. Yeah.
It's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Amir. I came from Tel Aviv, and it's a really honor to be here and to speak with you. I chose three objectives. It's a connected, efficient, and safe. Basically, Carbon is all about redesign the 911 industry, which is starting from users, solutions, infrastructure, and command and control centers. We are currently in 51 countries around the world, serving 100 million people. And to make it happen, you need the cities to be, while enterprises move to be on cloud and all, which we all are very familiar with, cities stay on everything on premise. They need to touch their infrastructure on the backyard because they think it's more secure. And cities are flooded by IoT devices, autonomous cars, drones, and many very interesting connected devices that are coming to cities. So first, they all need to be connected. Otherwise, you're going to have patches on patches on patches in a city which are not talking to each other. Efficient is coming from, in order to make urban innovation, they have to adopt new processes, such as reducing bureaucracy, reducing processes that is taking and killing entrepreneurs for bringing innovation into cities. And of course, we're all about safety, so I would say safety is the first layer to create all those kind of things, and that's what I chose.
Awesome. So I'd love to hear next about kind of how in each of your roles you see your company or your role kind of contributing to that vision. So whether that's a vision of equity, human centricity, connectivity, how you see your role and your company specifically doing that or working towards it.
Sure. So Uber has a huge amount of opportunity to do an awful lot in cities and communities that we serve across the globe. So we're currently in over 600 cities across all six continents. And we have billions of rides every week. And that's just with the car service, right? That's not thinking about Jump Bikes, which are the e-bikes. It's not thinking about Uber Eats, which is supporting a lot of local and also international restaurant chains and people to get food. So there's a huge potential, right? It's kind of grown very, very fast in its short life so far. And I think also with that growth, then comes the increasing responsibility of what a company can do like that. So we need to make sure that both to be competitive in the market and also to be doing the right thing, that we make sure that the earnings for drivers and the livelihoods they have are sort of a decent and good. So I think that's really important around equity. In terms of safety, I think our tech is kind of just sort of top when it comes to making sure that both passenger and driver safety is paramount, so that every trip can be tracked. If there are any problems, either within the car or kind of external to that, that can be kind of really safely recorded. So for a lot of vulnerable people, including women, to be able to have safe trips home, which is cashless, you don't have any of that friction, there's a huge opportunity there. The other thing that I find really interesting in terms of equity is also having a kind of actually this kind of network of humans, individuals who can be the eyes and ears of the city and who also help and kind of contribute and share back things that they see. So here in the UK, we've got really interesting partnerships with organizations such as Unseen UK and UK Says No More, which is really looking at things like child sexual exploitation, county lines challenges, which is where a lot of young people are being used to kind of move drugs around in different parts of cities in communities across the UK. So drivers can have the kind of, they feel like they are equipped and know how to spot signs and be able to report those without fear of any negative impact back on them themselves. And finally, I think that Uber has a huge opportunity in terms of what it does in terms of accessibility around those who've got additional needs, so they who may need wheelchairs, also a large range of those who've got disabilities who actually don't need a wheelchair, and what we can do to help create reliable, affordable, and efficient transport to help them move around as well. So those are kind of three areas where I think Uber has sort of a huge opportunity and an ability to be able to do more. On its social impact, which is a kind of nascent part of Uber, there's a real focus around safer roads and safer communities and around economic empowerment. So So we're really trying to think about what can we do not just as part of the business as usual, but also above and beyond that, so that we can be kind of, you know, a key player across both financial and non-financial metrics in terms of what we give back to cities. And then, of course, there's the whole other piece around the sustainability bit that we offer. And really want to try and push forward to sort of ultimately reducing congestion and private car ownership. But that's even a whole other side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting because you see examples in our world, like companies like Uber that have gone very, very quickly into global cities, and they're solving, or they have the potential to solve, of what you just said. I think it's great. Let's say what Uber did a couple years ago and what they're trying to do now is different, and I think you have the potential as a company to make those changes on a wider level that like governments are failing to do, right? I really think cities and governments are so inefficient that it's almost up to the tech, in a way, the opportunity and the possibility for tech companies to come in and solve some of these core issues that I actually think as a German, like governments and taxes should be solving, but they're not. Like my company is very different because we work with smart buildings and real estate owners, we're B2B, and then we have B2B2C, but we're mainly focused on B2B. But I think the data that we're collecting about how buildings are being used and the data that we can then share and give back to government for them to improve their neighborhoods and the people's experience in neighborhoods is sort of where our value to governments can come in as a company. And that's, I think there needs to be much more collaboration and communication between cities, governments, and companies, private public partnerships, like I said before. Because also I think there's not really many opportunities, or at least as a startup, I haven't been given so many opportunities from cities to actually partner with them. And if I've tried, they've been even slower than the real estate industry in terms of clients. And so then if you're a startup, you can't work with a company or an institution that takes 6 months to make a decision. You need to move faster. You need to focus on the companies and clients that are willing to pay and say, yeah, I get it. This is going to add a lot of value. Let's do it now. Let's not talk about it for a year, because in a year, your company can fail if you haven't moved on and haven't generated more clients. So I think there's a wealth of complexity around solving big social issues in cities. And I would like to see more collaboration across these different stakeholders.
Yeah, Amir, it seems like you would have a lot of insight into this specifically, especially around collaborating with governments.
Yeah, so first of all, it's very different working in different regions around the world. Just came back from Mexico. We have a 60% market share in Mexico. It's a totally different issue when you're working in the Met Police or Mexico City. It's totally different challenges and different economic models, different culture. It's totally different. But one of the things that we realized when we started the company, we thought to bring an app that everyone will click one button and we're sharing video streaming and location and chat and medical information and all that. And immediately we realized that if you want to create a real change, apps will not be able to create a standard, so we have to be source agnostic. So now one of the things that we've done together with our amazing partners such as Cisco and Amazon Government Cloud and some other big companies is to bring and to connect their IoT gateways into our solution. So for example, think about the fact that you're going to sleep in your apartment and there is a fire at the living room now, and Alexa have a heat detection and Alexa can detect that there is an unusual heat in your apartment and immediately alert the fire department, and you are still sleeping and the fire officer is coming to you and say, you can continue to sleep, we take over your fire in your living room. So it's really happening, and in order to make it happen, you need to build a sustainable virtual infrastructure, which is used to be currently, as I said before, totally on-premise, TDM-based, which is regular voice calls, no IP. And this is part of the market education the startup are driving governments to do and to educate them that having equipment on-premise is not really efficient. If you want to be scalable, redundant, if you want to have sustainable updates to your business, you have to move to the cloud. So this is how Carbyne is basically pushing governments all around the world, from Asia, Latin America, United States, Europe, to change a little bit their mind. It's hard, and the time to market is not like what we heard from Headspace, which is a B2C solution, that you are launching it and it's like spread like fire in the wood. But once you are in, you are win for a long time, and then you have a sustainable business to grow, and this is what...
You're locked in. Yeah. How many governments are your clients now?
Currently, we have around 31 cities using our solutions around the world.
So the clients are the cities, not the country?
So it depends. So we are working with the government of Singapore. Mm. We are working with the 13 counties in the U.S. We are working with Sao Paulo, Buenos Aires, State of Mexico, City of Mexico, and some other states in Mexico. Israel, of course, we have a big distribution in some cities in Europe as well.
And how long is your sales cycle?
So it depends. It depends on the country. So in Mexico, you can imagine that it's a bit different processes. In UK, it will take you 12 to 24 months. Yeah. But in Mexico, you can close a deal between 3 to 9 months. So it really depends on the economic cycle, which is something that we learned during the. So for example, it was just 3 or 4 months ago. It was elections in Mexico. So now they're releasing the funds. If you are missing that period, the next time that you will be able to sell to cities in about 1 or 2 years from now. So it's really learning the environment that you're working in. It's so it's really timing and learning your markets like in every other startup.
Yes, so one aspect of collaboration that you were mentioning is not just with governments, but with each other, right? So if we're thinking about the built environment, mobility, services, and connecting all of these devices that all of these other companies are working on, I guess what has been your experience around collaborating with each other, and are there kind of facilitating mechanisms right now or innovation that you see that could be happening in that space?
I think it's a great question. I'll just jump in because we're about to launch something really relevant to that. So next week, I'm on stage in Cannes in France at the biggest real estate conference in the world, 100,000 white men in suits, basically. So that's certainly an industry worth changing. But as a company, my company at District is a digital layer for the built environment assets. So whether it's commercial real estate, our first client was Blackstone. Our largest client is Cushman & Wakefield. We're doing 200 million square feet with them. Or largest, so property managers, real estate funds like Blackstone, or directly companies who manage their own office space and their own real estate, like WPP. So we're rolling out to 170,000 employees for WPP. And we found that every building is different. And every building, especially in the same portfolio, has legacy tech that's different. So it's extremely fragmented market. And the IoT smart building, lights, temperature, et cetera, is just booming. Like, you know, there's in the billions of IoT devices today. And so we help our clients connect what's valuable to the user experience into one platform, so one app or web login, instead of having, I truly believe in the consolidation of apps on your home screen, because you don't want to have 20 apps to do 20 different things. If it's in the same building, you want to have one app to do all of those things in your day-to-day work life. So that's what we believe in. And we're launching next week I think the world's first smart building tech marketplace. Like, Apple has an app store. District has a smart building store, so to say, where our clients can go online, pick and choose which features they want, and then configure the custom experience for their buildings. And our partners, like a door access company called DoorDeck in London that we work with across buildings, or another company called Waltz in New York, they have two different door access control solutions, but they both enable the same frictionless experience that I can be registered. Say you work in this building, you can book a meeting room with one click, invite a guest with one click from your address book. They get sent a wallet, like an airline check-in. You know how amazing it is to just walk into airports these days? Why doesn't that happen in buildings when you go to a meeting? You're 10 minutes late for every meeting because the receptionist has to get your name. They don't know who you're visiting. You have to go up. It's a big mess. I think getting in and out of buildings is our biggest pain point in our work life, commercial buildings. So anyway, that's just one example of an integration that we have, like access control, light sensors, temperature. And we believe in connecting all these other startups into one so that, you know, all the clients can have access. Yeah. And we're very excited about that. We're going to do hackathons, you know, hack your building and connect. And we're opening up our platform completely because we believe in openness and transparency. And we want other people to be able to build on top of it. We want to democratize what essentially WeWork has done for landlords and Google has done for offices, to allow anyone to have better, improved office experience and to retain talent. Mm-hmm. So I think we're 100% up for collaboration, and we invite everyone to build like on top of our platform. There could even be an Uber integration.
Yeah.
So you could book your meeting room and say, I need a car to get to that building, and then it would just you know, automatically integrate. So we spent the last year optimizing our backend to be able to open it. Like, there's a lot of work if you want to build open platforms to make that work, but it's very exciting. I could talk about that all day, so you better interrupt me.
Lovely. So Eugenia, did you have it, has Uber kind of, I know they're leading the charge around collaboration and thinking about, well, whether that's with governments or with each other or kind of pushing the fore on technology, I guess what has been your experience around achieving that level of collaboration necessary to get to that equitable, user-centered, smart city that we all envision?
Honestly, I think we're really far from it. So I only joined Uber in April of last year, and my background is entirely not in profit. So I was in like non-profits, charities, education, set up and ran some of my own before then moving across into this new world on the for-profit side of the spectrum. And it's been fascinating. And I think that collaboration, whichever side of the fence you're on, and whether you're kind of the big player or you're like the hungry little creature kind of looking to get in on somebody else's platform, it's really great in theory, and everybody wants to talk about it and everybody celebrates it. But in practice, it's really, really hard to work. And that is because you need to find genuine alignment where there's win-win for both parties, whether you're the big to the small, whether you're kind of two peers, et cetera. And also it's around trust and reputation. And I think Uber has been working really hard in the UK, across EMEA, over in the US and elsewhere to consistently, slowly and constantly over the last couple of years build up collaborative relationships with regulators and cities so that we move beyond just being an operator that in the UK law is known as like the fit and proper operator. We want to move beyond that. We want to be above and beyond that. We want to be the strategic partner. And that's happening and it's breaking through, but it's slow and it's iterative and it's challenging. And I think that that is partly because it's Uber, and Uber comes with a kind of whole, I mean, if I ask people in the room, if you're the kind of the word association, if I say Uber, what comes up in your mind? What's the first word? Your face. You just pointed at yourself. Great, I like that. Anything else?
Last trip I had with Uber was Tesla, so now I'm thinking of Tesla.
Tesla, great. Uber, that's Tesla, nice. That's great. Any other connections? Deliveries, yeah. You can also be so rude, coffee, by the way. You don't have to be nice. Yeah, exactly. There we go. Now the hands are coming up.
Taxi strikes.
Yep, strikes.
Centralized,
exactly. So there are both positive and negative associations, and I think that we have to be really live to that and sort of face into them when we're trying to build these collaborative partnerships. So my sweet spot, and I realize this, so talking with colleagues in Uber where, you know, there are sort of 12-month trajectories and kind of forecasts, etc. And I come from the world of nonprofit where you don't think about anything in 12 months because you're not going to affect any real change like within a year. You have to have a 3 to 5 year timeline. So my sweet spot, I've realized, is if you've got the quadrants of urgent and important, I'm in the like important, definitely not urgent category is like where I really like to hover. And I think that's where you can begin to set up and kind of have good strategic collaborative conversations. And I totally agree in terms of like understanding the pace of the partner that you wish to kind of work with or who wants to work with you. So it's not just a finding kind of mutual places where you want to work together and it will be a win-win for both, but also that the timing works well. Because if one person's rushing or one lot is rushing and the others have got, you know, 3 years, like feels like 4 months to them, that's going to be really hard too.
Yeah, just one really quick comment on that, understanding your clients. Like, one of my favorite things that a potential client said to me, his name is James Goldsmith, and he's running AXA's investment in 22 Bishopsgate. It's the biggest new development in London. It's going to be double the height of the Gherkin. It's like billions of dollars, pounds investment. And he was, you know, a year ago, he was ready to work with us and use our tech to showcase and market it. And then sort of nothing happened. And I was like, I sent you my contract. Why aren't you signing? Why aren't you signing? Why aren't you signing? What's happening? And then he said to me, no one has said that to me before in real estate, but he said, Vanessa, I'm so sorry. I was basically stopped by my colleagues. I'm used to making decisions that take 3 years with 100 consultants for a building that will then be, you know, live for 30, 50, 100 years. And
I cannot possibly get them all to agree on, you know, 2-week iterative tech sprints. And they all want something else from the tech platform. They all want the app to do something else. Mm-hmm. Nobody's agreeing. Everyone is basically so confused, and we spent so much money on salaries and rooms discussing this that essentially we can't move forward right now. We have to do nothing, not something. And it's a huge mind shift issue that if you're working in a big, whether it's government, real estate, or oil, or banking, I would say, you need to be able to speak to your clients in a way that gets, like, they get it, and you need to have enough time to get those deals. So, for example, we're speaking to Expo 2020 in Dubai. They're building a whole new city with Siemens. And the idea is to work with us to create a neighborhood app, which I'm really excited about. We're also speaking to King's Cross, Wembley, and other like neighborhoods where we could not only connect the building, but actually connect the public realm and a larger area. And anyone in the world could download the King's Cross app, see what's happening, events, etc. I think it's also a big push against loneliness. So everything we're trying to build is get you from the digital world back into the physical. Go to events, go meet people offline, connect with people in your office. Don't just spend your life in a virtual world, which I think the danger is, like Ready Player One. We're moving into a dystopian future where our cities are so shitty, nobody wants to leave their apartment. You can just go online and play games or watch concerts. Millions of people watched a digital concert. I don't know if you all read about that, like a couple of months ago. It was huge. And they're all 12 years old, you know. It's all the next generation of children. And I think we, or anyone working in cities has almost a responsibility to make our cities and our public realm attractive enough so that people don't just stay in front of their computers all day, because I think we have a huge problem with mental illnesses that come from our digital social networks that we're not even understanding right now.
Yeah, so kind of following along that vein of kind of making smart cities for humans that balance this ease and human centricity with that creepy factor, I guess.
Yeah.
How have each of you been kind of going about really keeping humans at the center and thinking about making their lives really easy, making those services accessible, making it possible to put out a fire while they're sleeping, but also keeping in mind that agency factor and helping people really have empowerment in their lives as well in these smart cities of the future? Amir, if we can start with you.
I want to add something to the previous note. I think that if we would like to see a real innovation in cities, it's something that have to be a cultural change in the cities. For example, in Singapore, they're working like a startup company. They're measuring everything. There is a clear KPI for every person that is working in the city. They have a culture. So it's really like managing a corporate. So if you are, for example, because of you brought smart lighting into your city and you saved $200 million this month, so you're being incentivized by the government for saving money for the government. Unlike many other governments around the world, where if you are not spending your budget, they will take your budget and move it to a different department in the city. So this is one thing that is needed to be changed in order to create a real collaboration and how people in the cities are thinking. Second thing is human resource. Yeah. The Minister of Technology of France is 35 years old. I met him a few times. He's fallen in love with our technology and he's really into change. So sometimes the people that are driving the change need to have this thinking about innovation and they need to live it in order to feel it. And I'm 33 years old, okay? We are already too old for the new innovation that is coming in and all the kids that are playing with crazy technologies and we are not up to date in those things. So I think the age of the people that are working in government is only influencing what you are seeing in cities. The third thing, I think, in order to not creating a mess, because there is a lot of innovation to bring into cities, you need to create standards. So for example, you saw it, we're seeing it now in Europe with the GDPR. So there is a lot of amazing apps that are using a lot of information and who knows what they are doing with this information. So governments are coming and trying to standardize what those agencies will do with our information, how people will have access to their information, how they are deleting the information if they needed to, et cetera, et cetera. And this is very important part. They are building the infrastructure for the growth in the future, because if you want to create a better future without creating a mess and creating uncontrolled monopoles, you have to create standards that are controlled by governments and giving the landscape of operating to companies to work in. And I think those 3 points are really important to create this future that we are all talking about.
Yeah. Awesome. And
So in terms of, yeah, fascinating, and I definitely align on several of those points. In terms of kind of the human-centeredness, I think there are lots of platform apps and kind of and tech in the world that is very much like not centered around day-to-day human interaction. So the kind of Amazons and the Facebooks and the Googles, you know, and it's kind of quite straightforward having that kind of platform tech. Uber is like just fundamentally different because it is about facilitating like where you want to move in the world or what you want to get and kind of retrieve from it. And we have these millions of random human encounters every day, complicated by the fact that they are often in moving vehicles. So it's like, you know, it's tricky and it's complex. And that it is like not managed by us in the way that the drivers and the customers are all kind of fully independent, so they can choose where they want to be and where they want to go. So it's just this kind of free marketplace that which Uber kind of manages, and it's in the kind of physical world. And actually, for me, one of the things that I really love, and I was actually just discussing before the panel, is that there aren't that many opportunities or places in cities any longer where you have these opportunities for random encounters, at least in many parts of the developed world where people are kind of head down in their phone or just talking to people they already know. We don't talk to people in the tube or in the subway. We don't talk to people in line at the post office. Not everybody goes to football matches. Not everybody goes to pubs. So where do we actually speak with like people who we would never normally encounter? And actually, sometimes, not always, but one place that can happen is in an Uber, right, when you're going from one place to another. And I think it's those micro interactions between strangers that actually help kind of glue cities together. And if you have millions of those micro interactions all the time, that actually kind of builds a kind of collective insight and knowledge and understanding that can help cities thrive and stay connected in a way and have a small impact on bridging that chasm, I think, that I was discussing right at the start. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's one of the things that I find really powerful about Uber and one of the things that I really champion about it.
Mm-hmm. Can I just say to Uber Pool, I think it's super interesting because for mm-hmm. me as well, I never speak with anyone in the tube, but if you get into an Uber Pool, there's this immediate connection, or I always say hi, and I usually end up speaking to the person for at least 2 minutes or 5 minutes, and it's a complete stranger, and I'm sitting next to them like I'm sitting in a tube, but because it's a car, it's more intimate, and I've found some really lovely conversations in Uber Pool, and that is very, very unique. Like, you don't have that in the tube or in the bus or any other transportation mode. And I think it's kind of cute and magical in a way. Like, I would second that.
Thank you.
I also think the algorithms and the big data that a company like Uber has, or something I'm trying to build up, if we can look at how people are interacting across cities, like, I think it's super cool. As an Uber driver, you can say, I want to go on my way home, and the algorithm just picks up a person on your way home, so you get paid to go home, right? And it can do that because it's smart tech. And if we could apply the same type of algorithms to other things, like for example, Sao Paulo has 50 million people almost. It's one of the biggest cities in the world. And there's a study that I read, which I found fascinating, about the people that live there, the highest quality of life, or the people that were most happy, have been able to hack their own life in a way that I realized I do as well in London, or in New York, when I live in New York, because I spend half my time in London, half my time in New York. These cities are so big, they're almost uncomfortable to live in already, especially commuting. So the hacking bit is like a trifecta of your day-to-day. So if I can go from my work, or my home, where I live, to my work, to my play, things, whether it's a restaurant or a bar, wherever, or sports, back to my work in a 10-minute or a 15-minute commute each way, I have a significant higher quality of life than if I spend an hour going away. And actually, most so in Sao Paulo, the study found that most people will actually not go to see friends that are too far away, or not go to, you know, a cinema if it's too far away. They'd rather stay close by because of the traffic. They don't have public transportation, and you're just stuck in hours of traffic, and it's really, really terrible. But traffic is a thing Uber, it's obviously big on, and Uber can optimize, or Waze, like I think Waze is also a really, really interesting company that was bought by Google, and they can optimize our streets until the point where we have fully autonomous cars, like with a
friend of mine that's doing a PhD in autonomous cars up here. And I think for me, my dad works with cars as well. I would love to live in a world where we all are in autonomous vehicles because they all can speak to each other, the vehicles do, and then we'll never have traffic. There's algorithms that define, like I studied engineering, there's algorithms that define how fast you can go on a road to never be in traffic. It's just a simple math problem. It's about the, you know, where you're going, how many other cars are there, and if you go a little bit slower, if everyone on the road drove a little bit slower, there'd be no traffic for that amount of cars. Mm-hmm. It's the same as like bird flying algorithms, fascinating to me. And you can map all that and we can create better cities, but we need everyone to opt in. And the autonomous thing is, it's not a tech problem, it's a legal problem. Who's responsible for a crash? That's why it doesn't exist yet. And you've seen examples of crashes that have been problematic for the whole space. So I don't know what the answer is gonna be to that, because it will require a lot of politics. And I think it's certainly a space I'm interested in politics, but very far away from, because I think it's very challenging. Cities, right?
Sorry. No, I think this would be a good moment to open it up to the floor for questions. We have about 30 minutes left in our session. So I'd love to, open it up. If anyone has a question, I will start with, how about you here in the front?
Hi, my question is for Vanessa. I work with a lot of shopping centers in China, which work like social hubs, because it's a complex. It has offices and cinema, like everything.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I was wondering, in the work of district, have you and your company identified any pain points for shopping centers that you are currently working on?
Yeah. So it's really interesting. We get asked a lot about shopping centers because there have been a lot of apps in the past that try to be like the shopping center app and get discounts here, but essentially they totally flopped. Nobody wants to download a shopping center app if it just shows them what shops are in there, because you know, I know what shops are there, I'm going there already. That's not valuable. What I do think is valuable is if you look at the shopping center, like what you just said, as a social space for people in cities, because the big shopping centers are dying. If you look at the real estate industry, nobody wants to buy shopping centers anymore. The high street, this concept of the high street dying is not actually the high street dying. It's the big shopping chains that are dying because people don't want to go there. People want to have experiences. People want to go to events and activations and interesting, like pop-up, retail, local, unique things. And so the high streets that have converted to that, or the shopping centers that have converted to that, like I've seen shopping centers with VR worlds, you know, go there to connect with other people, go there to play games. Those are the ones that are winning still and will stay around. I don't think they'll ever go away because people want to connect around experiences in the physical world. And so if we can encourage that, so we're speaking to Canary Wharf about doing a Canary Wharf app. They have a huge retail space underground. And one of their challenges is not only like, you know, wayfinding, but getting everyone who always goes to engage there and to stay there. I've been told I forgot if it was Singapore or Hong Kong, but people actually, you know, there's a huge amount of people that go to shopping centers to have picnics because there's a lack of public parks outside. So if you can't have a picnic outside in the park, where are you going to go?
Yeah.
There's very little public spaces left in our cities where you can just hang out with friends for free without paying. So I think that's really interesting, and certainly shopping centers will change into experiences moving away from retail. And I think there's lots of layers we can put on top of them. But we're speaking to Canary Wharf. That's our closest shopping center client right now. But it's about more than just that. It's mixed use. It's commercial people working day-to-day, residential people living there day-to-day, and then connecting them with the experiences. And that's the value.
Mm-hmm. Take another question. How about you there in the back? Yeah, you.
Hi, my name's Ed, and I work in getting everybody physically active, so we should all be standing up and we should all be walking around, so do all that good work. So challenges that I face is half of children aren't doing the right amount of exercise. There's a big childhood obesity time bomb coming up, and you started touching on it about your engagement with communities, and you sort of didn't really kind of take that leap that I'm interested about, is how do you sort of take your work and then go into other areas. So I'll give a good example is active travel is really, really important. So take the Uber example. You know, there's a competition potential element there of taking people out of your Uber cars and getting them cycling or walking. Mm-hmm. How can you sort of take me on that little journey, really, of how can you kind of work in that space?
That is like my dream question. Thank you. Nobody else asked me anymore. So Uber like sees itself as a travel sort of a platform, right? That it will help people in a multimodal way, which is like the travel like speak for sort of different ways of traveling around, and be able to do that in a seamless and kind of frictionless way. And actually, active travel is a really core component of that. So going back to the pool services, actually, one way to optimize that is to get people to walk a bit further, because that's actually going to reduce costs for them. And even those like micro changes, right, of just walking an extra 100 meters or 200 meters, is also then a kind of a pro-social and kind of pro-health nudge to getting people move a bit more. I'm particularly excited about the jump bikes, these kind of electric bikes. So a lot of bike share schemes see that the average distance traveled is between 1 to 2 miles on a kind of regular bike. Because you know the bike shares, like they're normally like super heavy, and you just sort of, you need to have like the will and energy and kind of half distance, half rate, even just to kind of like get them out of the lock. And what's great with kind of e-bikes is that actually a 1 to 2 mile average journey turns into 4 to 5 miles. So you can just get a lot further, and you don't have to be a kind of bike nut like who pre-owned a lot of spandex in order to then kind of be excited to get on them. It can be a way of kind of getting into cycling as opposed to something that might inhibit you if you feel nervous, etc. And actually, there was a story that just came out, I think it was last week or the week before, that where jump bikes and Uber cars exist in the same world, so particularly in Sacramento and San Francisco, in Sacramento, the number of trips on jump bikes has now exceeded the number of trips in Ubers. And that is hugely exciting, right? San Francisco is not far behind. Because actually, people realize, right, if you want to get somewhere quickly and efficiently in a city center, you don't need to do that in a car. Actually, it's public transport or it's active travel, which is going to help you get further, quicker, and more affordably. And that's something that Uber kind of massively, massively celebrates and wants to push. So we even had our head of EMEA write an open letter to regulators a couple of weeks ago, basically saying, please invest more in public transport. So we are fans of complementing public transport going forward, because that is the way that cities are going to survive and thrive and be the most sustainable, and also an active travel too. And that's something we're really pushing. The jump bikes are going to be coming. They've already just launched in Lisbon last week in Europe, and they will be coming to the UK at some point soon too.
How about you in the yellow? Yeah. Yes, coming. Thanks. So I live in Nairobi, and the services there are pretty minimal. There's no emergency services, no fire, no police, or they're very hard to find. Uber is there. There's a few smart cities, but I'm just wondering how you guys approach the developing economy, where the bottom of the pyramid doesn't have this kind of technology, so how do you get to them when they are usually suffering the most from not having these services?
So the answer is yes. We are started a small operation in Uganda and Ghana, and we are choosing the countries and the cities that we are going to operate in pending on our partners and the infrastructure that we build our solution into. Such as I said, Amazon Government Cloud. And the reason that we chose Amazon Government Cloud is because of compliances, security, and connectivity, and some other stuff. So we are basically launching our solution in the places where our partners that design with us the infrastructure are currently available in. Because without having them with us, we won't be able to give the cloud connectivity that we wanted to do. So depending on the infrastructure partner that we have, this is how we are choosing where we are going and where we are operating.
We do have Uber in Nairobi and a variety of kind of services there. One of the things I'm really excited about is the development of something called the HCV, so the high capacity vehicle. So it's a bit like Pool, but for a minibus. And it's basically, and what I find fascinating, right, it's basically taking the way that a lot of people have gotten around in kind of bottom of the pyramid, kind of emerging markets for decades, in one of those like equivalent of a tuk-tuk, or I'm not sure what it's called in kind of Kenya, but those kind of equivalents where just like everybody jumps into a small bus and they kind of stop where you need to stop and you get up where you need to go. And Uber's just taken that idea, kind of like done some kind of smart tech around it, definitely not my area of expertise,
And there's then trying to kind of put it back out in those markets to make it really safe and really affordable. So we've launched that in Egypt, in Cairo, a few months ago, called Uber Bus. And that's coming to more emerging markets as the year goes on. And I'm not sure if it's coming to Kenya, but anyway, there are sort of various others in SSA. And that for me is really exciting because it's taking kind of what exists kind of culturally and is there, and it's just seeing like what can we do to kind of optimize it, make it more efficient, keep it reliable, and make sure it's really safe. And kind of safety is of paramount concern there for sure.
I will add into that that we have two solutions. That one of them is pretty expensive, as it's building the entire ecosystem for countries where I usually have budget. And like Facebook Lite, there is a Facebook Lite application for countries where the connectivity and the bandwidth is not so high. So we have the same solution called C Lite. Okay, it's a plugin that basically when we are coming to development countries and they don't have the money to invest in order to build the entire infrastructure end to end. So it's a light version that can sit on their legacy solution without replacing anything. Okay, so it's a plug and play, literally 5 minute installation, and they can benefit from X amount of features that we have in our solution without having the entire suite, which is much more cost effective, reducing the risk, reducing the time to implementation, and obviously reducing the cost for those countries. So we do have both, and in places like Uganda where we launched our solution, so we started with the light version, let them, the gap I think between the current solution and what we can offer is very high, so it's like jumping from a pen and a paper to have a very, very advanced solution. So we have to have an intermediate solution. This is why we created this light solution, in order to educate them and work with them in order to basically understand the benefits. And at the right time, once we will have the infrastructure ready and we'll have the budgets, we will add the entire ecosystem.
Yeah, maybe I'll just add, as like the small startup on the panel sitting next to a billion-dollar business and a business that raised 30 million, as I found out, like, I would love to go into other countries and cities as well, but we just can't. We don't have the money or the resources right now. I think it's, you need to focus on getting clients where you can, at least as a startup, and then in the future, we hopefully can do some really cool, more charitable projects. Like we already have an idea that we want to discuss with Shelter, the homelessness charity in London, where, you know, I think a lot of people would like to give a little bit of cash, but they don't have cash on them. And also you don't know what the person is going to do with the money. So we thought, well, why can't, like, the tech I already have could very easily, because we have payments on our platform, you could very easily with the, like, it's similar to an access control NFC chip, you could just get a little, thing around a neck or with a chip or wristband, and you could actually just hold your phone and give someone money, like paying on the tube with the NFC. And so I think there's like super cool things you can do once you have the money and the resources to invest in more social projects. But as a I have 18, almost 20 people working with us, but we're so busy, we could not even approach markets outside of Europe or the US right now.
How about you here in the front?
I'm completely new to the whole concept of smart cities. I just wanted to challenge the notion that we've been talking about infrastructure and the sort of social spaces they allow or disallow. But I'm also thinking about, particularly being here in Oxford, sort of cities, sort of they stand for something, they've got something to give here, it's knowledge and so on. And what I see is, it's mainly about broadcasting. Broadcasting to come to our Harry Potter tour, or broadcasting here's a Nobel Prize winning professor buy his book, and so on. In how far that kind of process about interacting about the culture of a city, you know, is at any, on any of your agendas to make that more interactive and connected process?
Yeah, I'll take it. So on our app, we connect you with content happening in and around buildings. So if you work in an office space, say in this building, you could see an event going, like, or a Harry Potter tour or whatever, but it depends on the clients putting that content in. So it's really hyper-local, it's like your hyper-local newsfeed of what's happening right here. And I think that is kind of missing. There's no, it's very hard to find content or interesting cultural activities in cities unless you know what's happening already. So if you move from one city to the next, I think a lot of people struggle for 6 months or 12 months to like connect with what's actually happening in and around where they live or where they work. And that's something we're trying to make easier to connect with. But certainly it's a big, I think it's a big challenge making cities more engaging.
Yeah,
because it's so much noise as well. We have so much stuff thrown at us every day. How do we know what's actually worth going to?
We are not really into a culture of cities or something like that, but one of the things that we did in order to share information, so let me ask you, for example, if you're walking now in London or in any other major city, first of all, you don't know what's happening around you. So if I will ask you if there is any event now calling now to 999 here in Oxford or in London or whatever, you will never know about that, right? So one of the things that we've introduced in our solution is a shared map that you can see actually what's going on around you. And if you want, you can create like a certain radius. And you can say, if something happening around me in 100 meters, I would like to know. So if you're leaving your apartment and there is a car accident or whatever, so you can know about it. And cities can define if they want to share that information and what certain of level of information they are sharing. So they can show you there is an event, or there is a car accident, or there is a suicide bomber. So you can decide whatever, and they are basically making the level of sharing according to what they want, because sometimes it's not for the interest of the city, because they want you to feel safe and all that. So this is one thing. Another thing that we did is as a service to our clients around the world, I'm traveling all around. So you're landing now in Mexico City, and you have no clue what is the emergency number, right? And if something happened to you, we won't be able to know which number to call, and the language probably they won't understand you because they're speaking Spanish in the command and control. So one of the things that we added is it's supporting currently 160 countries worldwide. Like Uber, no matter where you land, you open it, you're taking a taxi. So same like we'd see now, our solution, you're landing, open it, they say, welcome to United Kingdom, the number adopted to support you. You're seeing a sign of police, so you don't need to know the number. In addition to that, we have a chat capability. So we can chat in English and they will see it in Spanish. So you can speak with the local authorities and you will write in your own language and they will see it in a different language. So this is kind of how we are contributing in
order to... What's the app called? I want to download it.
See Now.
See
Now. Now, yeah. So
is it live in London?
Yeah. Yeah. No, not in London. In the Met Police, not yet. I just had a very good meeting yesterday with BT and Cisco there. So this is the biggest police in the world. So once we will be there, probably we will be the size of Uber. So we have time to go. But we are, as a strategy, we are targeting tier 3 and 2 cities. So our strategy, like in Salesforce, at the beginning where they started, we are not going to the tier 1 of the world, like in the US. We will go to Georgia. We will start with the tier 3 cities, which are the big companies like Motorola, Lockheed Martin. They are not going to those because they are too small. But then you start to eat their lunch, you know, they're taking the tier 3, then you're going to the tier 2, and then you hit interoperability between the command and control center, and suddenly they realize that they lose their market because there is only one tier city that is currently using them, and they don't have a chance, and basically they're moving to your solution as well. So
we can integrate it into our building tech, so.
Oh, maybe.
Just collaborations happening now. Very quickly, so I love the question about cities. I see cities as Uber's third customer, so customers, drivers, and then cities, so riders, drivers, and then cities as a third customer. And I love how unique every city is. I'm also quite new to kind of the smart city thing. It's been around for ages. People have been talking about this stuff for a long time, and there's been kind of like sort of great tracks made forward, but also not very much progress made forward at the same time. So I find the whole thing around smart cities fascinating, but I think cities as this kind of unique ecosystem that is shaped by the humans that live in it and the geography on which they are built and the history and everything else. I just find it like a constant source of fascination. So I really appreciate the question, and I think I have the similar sorts of questions as you do, but not any of the answers.
Awesome. Let's take it from you.
Yes, you. No. No, not you. No. Sorry. Trying to go boy, go boy, go boy.
Thank you for being here. My question is if you can describe a couple of features of what your vision of a smart city looks like and what are a couple of challenges that prevent that from materializing in a very practical sense.
Yeah, I'll answer super fast.
So I think from Uber's perspective, the vision would be that you would say, I'm here, and I want to get to Port Meadow. It's like a bit further away. And I want to go in the most sustainable route. And that then I can pick like walking and biking or whatever it is, and I've just got like those options laid out ahead of me. Or I want to go in the most accessible way with like the fewest changes. Or I want to go in the most active way, i.e. I just need a really nice route for kind of running or walking or whatever it might be. Or I want to go in like the most the quickest way, so that just might be kind of a car. So that's the kind of vision that Uber would have. I think the pain points around that is actually, well, going back to that collaboration question. So it's like getting everybody on board so that we can do that together and make sure that if it's going through public transport, if it's going through kind of wayfinding sort of actually physically on the ground, so that it becomes as seamless in the real world as it could become very quickly in app if we had the buy-in from everybody and we could work together.
I will, in our use case, so there is few, so currently the 999 solution are, the way they call it, it's call handling, because it's only based on call that comes from people. One of the things that we are working currently with Cisco is to connect to their CCTVs, the cameras that you, in London there is more than 2 million sensors in the city, which are currently disconnected from 999 at all. So the idea is that if you have deep fusion in those cameras, you will be able to understand anomalies that are happening in the city. So if there is a car accident, basically the cameras will open a 999 call without having a human on the other side. This is one thing how we are seeing the future. Second thing is that if there is an event and we have a rule engine that can understand that there is more than 10 people reporting about certain thing, so we're currently working with autonomic drone company. So they will be able to launch a drone and open a new angle of video back to the 999 center. Because people, if there is an emergency, will not stand like this and film video like 20 minutes. So drones will come above them and basically will stream back information. And the call taker will be able to say to the person, thank you, you can leave the place. We're already managing it by a drone that is currently above you and seeing what's going on and reporting back to the police. So this is two use cases.
Vanessa?
Yeah, I think we said it all right. Okay. Frictionless, human-focused, efficient, safe, clean, green. I think we have.
Yeah.
We know what the ideal vision. Friendly, you know. Also, make it a nice place to live as a city. And yeah, I think we have a lot of challenges to get there.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a question over here in the front.
So my question is a bit different and a bit more long-term and macro. I'd like to hear all three of your opinions on it. From a smart city perspective, are any of you focusing on like the helpful use of blockchain or like distributed technologies and what that looks like for smart cities globally, but also individually your businesses? If you have any thoughts on that, that'd be great.
I can be very quick because I'm sure somebody in Uber is, but it's not me. So I'm not even going to pretend to try and bluff an answer to that. But I can definitely try and find out more and share with you so I can connect with you after, for sure.
Yeah, I think blockchain is a big buzzword right now, especially in real estate. A lot of people like to talk about it. I always say, you know, if they're scared of implementing a community app, they're certainly not going to put their buildings on the blockchain. Good luck. But it's the use case in real estate is one of the most, I think, accurate, because you can tokenize bricks, essentially. So it's about crowdfunding and investing in buildings or finding unique ways of building better buildings and cities. And I think the blockchain will be a big part of that in the future in terms of decentralization. But does it really, I think, long term? There's a lot of problems with the blockchain in terms of how much energy it's using, in terms of how much it costs. It's a hugely polluting type of technology. If cities did adopt it, alone the data centers and energy needed is already now a big problem. So I don't know if it is the solution or should be. And I'm certainly no blockchain expert either, but those are sort of my two cents.
I think that government in general are not early adopters. So usually they're following trends that are happening in enterprises like 5-10 years after. So for them to bring video into 999 was, well, oh my God, now the call takers will see video, how you're kidding me, and we have to do a lot of training to been through. So this is one aspect. On the other hand, I think that there is a lot in government which will be very relevant for blockchain. In Israel, we have a lot big industry in blockchain, so it's about the technology and not all the cryptocurrency and all that. This is something that I think is still shaky. No one knows really what will be the future of it, but the technology of blockchain, which is basically securing evidence, for example, and the ability not to change information, so it's related to criminal records, it's related to contract that you have with the government, so I don't know, your apartment. You just bought an apartment and it's now listed in a certain database, right, in the government. So in the future, maybe it will be listed in a blockchain database that no one will be able to change, and if you have it, it's kind of writing on the stone, so no one can change it, and you have a proof that it's there. So I think there is some implementation for blockchain in government in general in this ecosystem, but it will take time to see it because there are slowly to adapt new technologies, and it's something that is still not clear enough for them to be able to massively adopt.
How about you here in the front?
Thank you. I'm from the London School of Economics, MSc, and I'm interested in understanding your perspective on the use of air taxis. Mm-hmm. It also links, I think, to smart cities and how we can shape the future. So a question to all three of you. Pretty much what, in terms of politics, is actually stopping you from adopting that? Because I think in terms of use case and also business models, actually, it's very interesting for all of your companies.
Yeah. Maybe I'll start. It's happening. I have a friend called Duncan Walker. He has a startup called Skyports. And they're leasing or taking the option of leasing the tops of your towers. So they have the same type of clients I do in terms of real estate. But their whole thing is they want to have a contract which in the next 20 years gives them an option of having the sole use of that rooftop. So they've sort of signed a lot of the big, most prominent towers. And they now have the ability to then take that option, put a landing type of helipad thing on it, and they see it happening. His vision is it'll be transport first, so packages, Amazon packages, drones for deliveries, and then air transport, people transport next, whether it's Uber or another company actually operating those autonomous flying helicopter type things, as we've all seen them in sci-fi movies, but also in reality. So Airbus has one. Does Uber have one already? Mm-hmm. It has one.
Yeah, just did its first pilot.
They've done them in Abu Dhabi and Dubai. Like, there's some super cool videos if you look them up on YouTube. So I think the tech is there and the adoption, people are getting ready and they're just waiting. Like, Duncan's company is just waiting on the regulators to say, yep, now you can give it a go. And I think in the 80s, helicopter rules in London were a lot more lax. So actually a lot of wealthy people would be flying around from one rooftop to the next with helicopters until someone died in a helicopter, and they turned basically the regulatory laws shut that down. And now there's very, very little, if any, helicopters in central London because they're just not allowed. So it's not a technical, I think it's a regulatory question. And there's a lot of work in terms of policy that need to be more open to innovation, I think. Mm.
Yeah, we're so LA and Dallas are the two cities that are kind of targeted for Uber Air. The VTOLs, apparently, vertical takeoff and landing devices, known colloquially as flying taxis, set to start in 2023, apparently. So not too far, and an international city still being looked for. So again, I think I agree on the kind of regulatory point that that is definitely going to be a hold up. And so trying to find markets where that can start. And then thinking about, that's obviously going to start with a niche like market and clientele. And then I'm really interested about, particularly because of my background, right? Like, what are the other use cases that that can expand to and evolve to over time?
How about you in the back? Yeah, you. You're looking around. Yeah, you.
Yeah, I work for a large bank and I work in risk management. So my question is, there was a recent incident where one of the AI algorithms exhibited specific biases towards specific, types of people. So what's your opinion on the risks that smart cities pose onto society?
This is talking personally rather than sort of the voice of Uber. I'm fascinated by algorithms and predictions. And I mean, when you look at it in terms of sentencing, so looking at kind of how people were sentenced over in the US, sort of various studies done and how algorithms can have a kind of bias that's sort of based on how things are being programmed. So I find I feel very nervous about that, but I also think that conscious of the biases there, that we'll be able to be, we'll become smarter and better about trying to mitigate against some of the biases. It's never going to be fail safe, right? So if we presume that algorithms know the answer to everything, then we're really in trouble. but I think that there is a huge opportunity, and it's just a massive learning curve for us. So that's a kind of a personal answer rather than a professional answer. We have a whole team of scientists looking at algorithms as ways to do things. So very straightforward ways of, like, actually how do we optimize services like Uber Pool to make sure that we can kind of pick people up in the most efficient way, using the kind of least amount of miles traveled, et cetera. So those are things that can be kind of much more straightforward when it's then looking into kind of human behavior and sort of how to judge sort of humans. I think that's where there are much greater risks at play, but still not kind of insurmountable.
So I think that when you're asking about risk, it's all about the balance about the values that you will get from AI technologies. So for example, of course, there is some upside which might be disadvantages of using AI, but in our use case, again, one of our vision is basically to own the entire 911 flow, okay? And currently, if you will look at the people and the command and control centers and the amount of human interaction that is needed in order to dispatch a police car to an event is unbelievable. So what we are currently doing, our system was built to be many to one, one to many. So we are getting a lot of information, analyzing it, and then sending the information back to the forces on ground. So I know who is the person who is calling. I know his location. We are using speech to text, so I can really understand. Hey, I'm seeing a fire, so I can recognize the word fire. And I also can learn from previous events how those agencies handle those events. So basically, with big data and AI algorithms, we have the ability to give recommendation first to dispatchers how to react. Okay, so we're not making the decisions for them, because there is a lot of responsibility and liability here in this in our specific sector. But I can tell you that bringing automation and AI into that into the public safety saved tremendous amount of time and lives. And again, it's all about the risk versus the values and the amount of people that will save their lives. And I can tell you that with our solution, just to add few components of automation into that field, we reduce the time to dispatch, which is the time to making decision whether or not to dispatch forces, by 65%. So if you are talking about 10 minutes call, reducing 65%, because you don't need to ask 999 what is your emergency, because you actually can see the emergency, can see the location, understand who is the person, and sometimes even know some background information about him, it's tremendously helping. So it's all about balance and mitigating the risk, but I'm sure that you will see more and more AI into that specific sector as well.
Awesome, I think we have time for one more question. How about you there in the back?
Hi, so I work in the area of inclusive cultures and helping people to belong. And one of the things that came in your discussions was getting the online to offline, and that was in the morning also, of how loneliness can be overcome. And especially with Uber, when you come into a new city and you're a stranger, I think your first encounter is with the driver of your Uber. And while Uber makes you feel safe, and I can personally say that when I go to Paris or Brussels or New York, it's the same platform. But how can you get some authenticity of connecting to the real culture through these platforms that you have? That's my question to all of you, actually, but Uber first.
So I love that question, and I feel like that's almost like one of my own like personal research questions as I go through my role here in the company. So I don't have an immediate answer for you right now. So how do you get tourists or kind of strangers to places to feel more integrated using sort of Uber? I think being able to sort of navigate without as much friction as you have done previously and kind of safely and without cash, I think that's kind of one piece as you've just described. But that's only superficial, right? So how do you sort of get in even deeper? I don't know the answer to that. Some of the things that we're doing kind of in cities to try and work to get more people to kind of connect and integrate and feel included and less isolated. So we work with various charity partners in cities, and we give them kind of just credits per month so they can get people who would otherwise struggle to attend their events or services to be able to get there in a kind of straightforward way. So one example is in Bristol, we work with AGK, and old people who've got leg injuries, there's a leg clinic that a lot of people can't get to because it's just difficult for them. So they just get an Uber there and back, and then it sort of just builds in the kind of confidence to go further. So that's kind of very separate, and that's not connecting the kind of stranger to a place to the kind of humans who kind of live there and everything. But I think it's sort of a different answer. And the more that we can then think about how we can sort of join up those interactions, that's something that I find really fascinating and is definitely kind of top of mind.
Yeah, I would like to give an example from Airbnb. I think Airbnb built a really great culture where they encourage the host to give you tips and local recommendations and talk to you about the culture and actually meet your guest personally. And I think that also showed in their reviews that actually people really liked that, and the better hosts, the hosts that had more personal touches, we get better reviews, we'll get more bookings, and so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's a real value to people visiting those cities. So I think they did a really good job at encouraging that, and they identified it as one of their key focuses very, very early on, in addition to photos. I believe that made a big difference, them sending professional photographers to make it look more welcoming. Instead of people having to make their own photos. And so I think it's not really related to what I do in terms of my business, but if you did have a business that was about adding more of a human touch, I think you can look at companies like Airbnb who have done that really well. And Uber is probably trying to do that, but I've never gotten into an Uber and got a tour of the city yet, so maybe one day they'll train the car drivers to have some history knowledge of the city. That would be nice.
Awesome. So, Amir, did you have anything to add?
No, I'm just saying, I think that cities have a lot of power to help companies to be successful. So if we'll take an Uber as an example, so once you're limiting, for example, the amount of people that can drive into cities in a single car and forcing people to share cars and not being a single driver in a car, so it's something that you're thinking about public transportation. If you are now getting into a city like in Shanghai, and in Shanghai, you cannot, if you're not living in Shanghai, you cannot get with a car in Shanghai. If you're doing it, you're paying fees. Okay, so it's also forcing people, so it's something that is regulated by the cities that you're working with. So I think that cities have a lot of power. We are working a lot with the mayors, because at the end, they have a lot of political value of collaborating with us or in companies like Uber and others, because it's bringing innovation, it's touching the people, it's making their life better. So I think that if one of you have a startup in the city, so one of the things that you need to ask yourself is, what can the city invest in my company, not in terms of money, but what kind of assets I can leverage by working with the city. And sometimes they have a lot of power.
And I would just like to add, because I think it's super important what he just said, how powerful cities are. Cities also shut down companies, right? I think the big elephant in the room is Airbnb and Uber have been shut down by cities consistently, making it extremely hard for them to scale globally if they're being shut down. And so if you read, there's a book, I met this guy called Bradley Tusk, and he wrote a book called The Fixer, and his whole thing was, he was in politics and he joined Uber to help, he joined really early to help basically fix the political issues that would have shut the whole company down. The company wouldn't exist if he hadn't opened up the regulatory landscape for them. And so if you are a company trying to do quite innovative things in cities, just be really, really careful about getting your regulatory war treasure chest full, because you're going to have a lot of fights with cities. And if you're on the other side, if you're working in the city or in a government, I would say, like, also pick your battles, because if you're shutting down companies that are adding value or making cities safer, why do that? You know, it's like so much money and trouble for things that are actually adding value to people's day-to-day life. Yeah. So I would say let's pick our battles and try and make the world a better place, not a more negative place.
Awesome. So we're just about at time. I apologize. I know that there are lots more questions, but we are going to go to lunch right now, and I believe that our panelists are very generous with their time and will be willing to speak to you. But just to sum up kind of what we've been talking about, it sounds like making smart cities smarter has come down to bringing us from the virtual world to the physical world and creating those social experiences that bring us closer together. We've discussed collaboration, both between the people that are doing the innovation, the regulators that might be either creating obstacles and opportunities, like you mentioned, for those for these innovators to kind of come in and make ripples. And we've also talked about the technology itself. So we talked about blockchain, we talked about the marketplace, we talked about the amazing things that each of these companies are doing. And I think it's really at the intersection of creating really human-centered experiences that promote equity, that promote collaboration, and that really bring the best of what technology has to offer to make our lives better, that smart cities are gonna become smarter. So thank you so much for joining us, and hope you enjoyed.